This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, April 22nd. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. On Wednesday, after winning the Republican primary in New York, Donald Trump spoke at a campaign rally about the upcoming contest in Pennsylvania.
And if you win Pennsylvania, you get 17 delegates. And the rest of them are up for grabs. And then they can take the delegates, they can put them in airplanes and fly them to resorts, they can have dinners with them, they can put them in hotels. Essentially what they're saying is they can buy the election. I think it's such a bad system. It's so unfair. I call her Crooked Hillary. I can tell you this is a crooked system. This is a bad, bad system.
Adam Gopnik joins me to discuss Trump's latest crusade against the fairness of our electoral system. Welcome, Adam.
Hey, Dorothy.
So, whining aside, doesn't Trump have a point? I mean, we've got primaries and caucuses. Early states are given disproportionate attention. Delegates are chosen by voters in some cases and by party leaders in others. And then we have different systems for assigning delegates to primary winners. I mean, it's just utterly baffling to many people.
Well, we have a baffling, in many respects, inequitable system. There's no question about it. But I think the thing that Donald Trump is forgetting, as I think Bernie Sanders might have forgotten, and is that, as I wrote this week, that a political party is an instrument of democracy. It's not an institution of democracy. You can form a political party. It'd be perfectly appropriate to form a political party whose whole end was to nominate Lyndon LaRouche or Captain Kangaroo or the Powerpuff Girls, or whomever you like. Political parties can be just as arbitrary and absurd as, indeed, they often are. And the notion is that if they were that arbitrary and absurd, they wouldn't attract members. They wouldn't attract adherents and believers. And that the reason that our parties have become more democratic very recently in historical terms, just really over the last 50 years, really since 1968, is because presumably it better reflects their adherence and better reflects their will. But there's no rule or reason why their internal structure has to be equitable in that way.
You mentioned parties are actually more democratic than they used to be, which seems like a surprise to hear in this particular election year. This is the week that Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton won a Pulitzer Prize. And you point out in your piece that the founding fathers themselves hated parties because of how they encourage faction. I can't resist playing a clip here from the musical, and we're hearing Thomas Jefferson talk about Alexander Hamilton.
Every action has its equal opposite reaction. Thanks to Hamilton, our cabinet's fractured into factions. Try not to crack under the stress. We're breaking down like fractions. We smack each other in the press and we don't print retractions. I get no satisfaction witnessing his fits of passion. The way he primps and preens and dresses like the pits of fashion. Our poorest citizens, our farmers, live ration to ration. As Wall Street robs them blind in search of chips to cash in.
Talk a little bit about that and how we ended up here.
Sure. Well, I am one of those unrestrained Hamilton lovers. I arrived at Hamilton expecting to be snooty about it and thought it was just one of the five greatest things I've ever seen on stage. And as a consequence, it made me sit down and do what everyone should do eventually, which is to read the goddamn Federalist Papers, right? It's fascinating that Hamilton and Madison weren't just suspicious of parties or unsure about them. They really hated the whole idea of party because party for them represented faction. It meant little groups of people, men, of course, bonding together to advance their interests and their interests of their friends against the long-term values and interests of the country. And it's fascinating to read it because exactly one of the arguments that Hamilton and Madison make most often for the Constitution is that it will eliminate the power of parties. Because if you have a representative republic, it means that the people you're sending to the Congress will, by their nature, be removed from the passions of the street, and they'll be able to make objective, disinterested decisions. It's not work out exactly as they imagined that it would.
And why is that? What did they fail to foresee?
What they failed to foresee is something that at another level they understood perfectly well, and that is you cannot eliminate differences about fundamentals among people, as in other parts of the Federalist Papers they understand perfectly well. The reason the factions grow up isn't because, or isn't only because, there are little groups of self-interested people who are trying to defend slavery or Wall Street or these days Goldman Sachs on the one hand or the evangelical church on the other. No, the reason that factions and parties grow up is because we have fundamental differences about the right way to conduct the business of the country. One of the things that outrages liberal Obama lovers is the way that the Republican Party came together in early 2009, even before the president was inaugurated, to say we will offer him absolutely no cooperation of any kind at all, even in this time of crisis. And that seems to us to be an instance of faction at its worst in the Federalist sense, just saying no because you put the interests of your party ahead of the interests of the country. But if you think about it in a slightly more objective way, the truth is they genuinely believed that the things Obama wanted to do, a big recovery act that involved a lot of federal spending, a national health insurance and so on, that these things were destructive to the long-term interests of the country. So factionalism almost always translates into foundationalism of some kind, into a genuine argument about the fundamentals of the country. And there's no way of eliminating that kind of difference because they're inherent to living in society.
So do you see what we're seeing this election year as inherently healthy?
I do. I'm in a tiny minority who does. But I think you can see it as healthy if you see it in a long enough historical perspective. What we're seeing with this kind of fight is exactly what parties do. They bond together like-minded people who agree about foundations, and then it's the job of the democratic institutions to make equitable, majority-based decisions. One of the things that I think is striking is the way, and many people have pointed this out, is that for the first time in modern American history, we have real ideological parties. And that's one of the reasons why I think this year's events are so unsettling to people. When you and I were growing up, Dorothy, the Democratic Party was this bizarre coalition of Southern segregationists in many cases, and Northern liberals and African Americans, and there were plenty of deeply conservative Democrats in the Republican Party. No one remembers this now, right? But there was a time when the governor of New York State, both senators, were all Republicans, and that was because they were all liberals.
Yes.
They were all more liberal than almost any Democrat you would find now. And that kind of broad coalition party, which had emerged from historical accidents, is gone now. Now we have a very far-right Republican Party and a center-left Democratic Party. And whenever you have parties that are essentially ideological arrangements rather than arrangements of convenience, their far wing tends to pull them in that direction.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
The question, though, is whether voters are being hindered from getting what they want. For example, the mainstream Democratic strategist Mark Penn wrote this week that out of a country of about 321 million people, Clinton and Trump will get about 10 to 12 million votes each by June. That's votes from less than 4% of the country.
Well, that's far more than was typically the case in American history. I just was reading Robert Caro's wonderful book about the Johnson-Kennedy, the 1960 election. And in that case, if you recall, basically you had a very few primaries that were essentially symbolic contests to see if a Roman Catholic like Kennedy could win in a Protestant state like West Virginia. But that's really all they were. The decisions about what delegation would vote for who were made by the party bosses, if you see them that way, by the elected officials of the party, if you want to see it in another way.
I have to cite one of my own favorite little details, and I was thinking about this because Ted Cruz has been so masterful in driving Trump completely crazy by going out and lining up these delegates. Ted Cruz, whatever else you might want to say about him, he's very smart and he knows his history, and I'm sure he remembers the Republican Party has had 10 brokered conventions. Probably the most dramatic to me was in 1860 when William H. Seward, the world-famous anti-slavery senator from New York, he was expected by everyone to win the nomination in Chicago. He had 37% of the delegates. Lincoln had only 22%. Seward didn't even bother to go to Chicago. He thought he had it completely nailed. Yet Lincoln's men worked the floor more masterfully, and he won on the third ballot.
Well, you know, I think that that's a good example on two scores. One, right, let's remember that the Republican Party, ho, 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 originally emerged as the radical egalitarian party with a very strong abolitionist wing, of which Lincoln was not a member. I mean, Lincoln was strongly anti-slavery, but not part of the radical abolitionist trend. So he was the moderate solution to the problem of how you'd find the right candidate. It strikes me that as an example as well of how new parties need to form and how new parties are formed. One of the questions that I think fascinates anybody with an historical sense about what's happening this year is if the Republican Party, as it's currently constituted, can survive the nomination of Donald Trump. If exactly the people, the hawks on the one hand, the internationalists and so on, will be able to stay within that party, and if there doesn't need to be, and if it wouldn't be appropriate to have another kind. Because of a sort of accident of our social arrangements, in a way, we tend to treat the two big political parties as though they're permanent creatures that can't be altered. We tend to forget that these are tentative arrangements of supposedly like-minded people. You know, it's one of the things that's always entertaining if you follow French politics at all, is that the parties change about every 4 years. They change every time they have a new leader, because it's understood that that's essentially what it is. It's a coalition in support of one man. We haven't had that kind of party turmoil in a very long time, and it might be healthy and inevitable that we do.
So the eruption this year of activists, Ted Cruz, Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, is, in effect, the voice of democracy speaking.
Yes, in all of its tumult and occasional ugliness. I think there are two fundamentally different things going on, though. You know, misery loves company, and conservatives love false equivalents. So they want to see what's going on in the Republican Party and what's going on in the Democratic Party as being mirror images of each other. Doesn't strike me, at least, as a non-political observer, as being quite true. Because on the Democratic side, you have exactly the kind of populist insurgency that it seems to me you've had every single cycle, whether it was Jerry Brown or Jesse Jackson, or even in a weird way, people now forget Bill Bradley in 2000, you have this history of there being populist insurgencies in Democratic primaries, which are then usually won by what we call a centrist, but I would sooner call a liberal candidate. Indeed, Obama's insurgency was, or started to be, had some of the characteristics of that kind. And let's not forget, by the way, that Obama won in part because he read the rules on the back of the game box better than Hillary's people did, better than Mark Penn
Absolutely.
Did, right?
Absolutely, yes.
So Obama was a hugely popular figure, but that's how he won, or in part how he won. But that's what's going on in the Democratic Party, and it's par for the course, and it happens all the time. What's happening in the Republican Party seems to me very different. It's true that you have a consistent ideology that passes from Barry Goldwater to Pat Buchanan to Sarah Palin to Donald Trump. Those figures are all more like each other than they are unlike. But that line, that ideology, that extreme right-wing militarist nationalism has never been triumphant in quite the way that it threatens to be right now. That's a much more fundamental earthquake-like change than one more populist insurgency in the Democratic Party is.
Absolutely. Agreed. I want to ask you just one final question, because it's come up before on this program, about Hillary Clinton, who to many voters represents the 90s-style Democratic Party more than she does what the party is becoming in the 21st century, assuming that she becomes the nominee. Do you think that the party will change in significant ways?
I love the 90s, right? I'm like the last person who loved the 90s. They were a very good time, if you think about it, in all seriousness, in American history, a period of remarkable and to some degree increasingly shared prosperity and peace. So I think that 90s nostalgia is not necessarily an evil thing. I do think, and I see it as one who is often accused of reducing everything to family politics, let me report that the family politics in this family, and I wonder if not in many others, suggests as much. My 21-year-old is a passionate Bernie supporter, and that the objections, the puzzled objections that his father gives, those of us who were scarred for life by McGovern and Mondale, right?
Yeah.
And seeing 48, 49 states vanish in the fog of accusations of leftism, we're all scarred by that stuff for life. They grew up in the Obama era. So they find nothing puzzling or unbelievable in the notion that social democracy could triumph in America because of some form of liberal progressivism has. I do think that's an enormous change, and I think it's a good case where the traumas of the parents are not, fortunately, being visited on the children.
Thanks so much, Adam.
Fantastic to talk to you.
Adam Gopnik is a staff writer and the author of, among many other books, Angels and Ages, Lincoln, Darwin, and the Birth of the Modern Age. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can find more political analysis and commentary from Adam Gopnik and others on NewYorker.com or on the New Yorker Today app, available at no extra charge from the App Store and Google Play. You can rate and review the Politics and More podcast on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Duboff for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.